This is Digital Music Trends, episode 118, recorded on the 30th of January, 2013. So hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends, the show that brings you all the latest news in the digital music and technology space. So the show is available both as video and audio. You can find it on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Mixcloud, TuneIn, TuneIn Radio, and your favorite podcatcher. So I'm extremely happy today to welcome to the show two great guests. So Glenn Peoples, Senior Editorial Analyst at Billboard. So hi Glenn, and thanks for joining us on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And then we have Jay Herskowitz. Jay works on a bunch of digital media and tech music projects and is also one of the main contributors to open source project Tomahawk. So hi, Jay, how's it going?
Good. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Great. So we'll talk a little bit more about Billboard and the Tomahawk towards the end of the show. But today we have quite a few stories to run through. And I apologize if my voice sounds a little bit raspy, but it's the day after the Medium aftermath. So I only got back yesterday, so it was pretty heavy. So we'll talk about Björk's Kickstarter, the growing battle between streaming services, CDs revenues in Japan, indie labels attacking MySpace, and more. So let's start with Björk. So she made some headlines yesterday as being yet another high-profile artist to launch a campaign using Kickstarter. So the artist launched a Kickstarter campaign around Biophilia, her eighth studio album, which is people are going to think, oh, this is an old project, but actually she wants to port the app that she did into Android and Windows 8 for iOS. This is all to do with the educational side of the app, apparently, since you know, she launched an educational program with Biophilia that encourages kids to learn more about music through the Biophilia app. And she wants to raise $375,000 towards that. You know, of course, it's a fairly regular Kickstarter campaign. It's got rewards ranging from prints, art prints, to all the way to £800. Rare proofs of Biophilia and all that. So, the first thing is how important is an artist like Björk that has, of course, a worldwide appeal using Kickstarter as a crowdfunding platform. Glenn, what's your take on this?
Well, I think Björk might be the most well-known artist maybe to use a crowdfunding platform.
Yeah.
There's a big asterisk here because it's Android platform, and I wonder if this would do a lot better if it was an iOS platform, because this Biophilia app's been out for I don't know how long has it been. Has it been a couple of years?
Almost, yeah, it must be. Out?
So it doesn't look like the first couple of days the pledge was really rolled in huge numbers.
Yeah, it's only 3% at the moment.
So £375,000, actually, not dollars.
Yeah, you're right.
And it's got a long way to go. And we'll see if Android users can pony up the money like I think iOS users would. So, but I think it's really big news that Björk has gone to Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Or gone to any crowdfunding platform to raise money for this. When she could raise the money a lot of different ways for this.
Yeah.
Now, if this were a recorded music project or a tour, this would be, I think, even bigger news because Björk has been doing music the traditional way for a long time. But still, I think this is another sign that crowdfunding is going more mainstream every day.
Yeah. And Jay, what's the take on the project? And also, what do you think the repercussions might be if she doesn't get to the goal?
Yeah, that's a good question. If she doesn't make it, how much of a hit that is in terms of just her audience and her fans, or if she feels like that's going to have some negative impact in kind of her overall position. I think crowdfunding is definitely an interesting trend to watch, obviously. So you're going to see, I think, a lot more people, as people are already doing, focus on how do you build those relationships first. Because once you have those relationships, like an Amanda Palmer or somebody else, then you've got the ability to come in and try to crowdfund, leveraging that community you already have, maybe even before, you've ever recorded the music. I wouldn't be shocked to see maybe some more kind of internet celebrity folks that maybe are dabbling in music decide, hey, I want to record an album and I can just go this way. And, maybe they've got a YouTube channel or maybe they've got, a lot of followers on Twitter because they are a celebrity. So I think it's a really interesting thing to see how that it continues to evolve and how that affects kind of the traditional label mechanisms. But
Absolutely. It's kind of, I would love to see an artist like her actually go live with a campaign for her new album. I think that would be super interesting, because the problem with Biophilia is that, like we said, it's a project that's been out for a couple of years. She's already done quite a few special projects around it. So she did have like a special edition book, and she had a few more bits and bobs that came with the release of the original album. So a lot of the hardcore fans will have all that stuff. It's just a question whether there's enough hardcore fans left for her to actually be able to sell out of all the other options that are on Kickstarter. And that's an open question, I guess, at this point. And Glenn, you also had an article this week about the three signs that crowdfunding that we've seen recently that show that crowdfunding has really reached a new level here. So first is Björk's Kickstarter, and then the involvement of really high-profile publicists into Kickstarter or Pledge Music campaigns. And the third is the incredible result of the band Protest the Hero, which has raised more than 262 grand with still 16 days to go on their campaign, which is more than double what they were looking for. So like Jay was saying, major labels talked for years about piracy as a major threat to their incomes and their model, but the crowdfunding is now maybe becoming almost like an even bigger threat for them, as artists that are already popular may decide that they can strike it on their own at the end of the contracts and actually proceed in that way. So do you think that they're worried about these platforms taking on?
It's really hard to say. I think some of these artists were going to leave anyways. The artists who are in a position to go the crowdfunding route are the ones who were in the position to do the pay what you want Radiohead model, or the Trent Reznor model, or they're the ones who have the fans who are in that lucky position who don't need their record label so much anymore. There's always going to be a band that has very little and they need help along the way. And record labels are great for them. But I think the crowdfunding model is really good for the people who don't need that anymore.
Yeah.
So there are different scenarios for different bands and different points in their life cycle.
Yeah.
What really stood out to me about other bands who are having success. The third example was on Indiegogo. It wasn't even a Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And that would be Kickstarter's second most successful music campaign behind Amanda Palmer. A lot of the emails I get from publicists, and that's really a sign that this is very mainstream. If you have a crowdfunding campaign, you hire a publicist now. You're not just working with your fans. You have to get the word out, which means there are a lot of these, and it's taken very seriously, and this is just not some weekend hobby thing. This is very professional.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Glenn, how often are you getting publicists hitting you up about some new crowdfunding campaign?
Well, it's really in the last couple months, and it's one, maybe two a week.
Right.
But I would say it's only happened really in the last couple months. I don't see that slowing down, really. I mean, I'm sure that this is just going to continue. And now it's Pledge Music, now it's Indiegogo, and it's Kickstarter. So it's not just Kickstarter, there are other ones, and Pledge Music it looks like they're doing great too.
Absolutely, and I had a really great chat with Benji that is going to go on the site later this week when I get the time to edit it for Medium. And they have a really different approach to how they do the whole thing, and he was talking about how Kickstarter is really great for more hardware projects, because you set yourself a deadline, you have the funds, and then you can start producing it. But with music, it's a whole different ball game, in that with Pledge you can actually keep buying the album all the way to the release. You don't have a hard deadline, and you don't have to really with Kickstarter these days, if you want to pledge for or want to get an album from a band where the Kickstarter campaign is already finished, you don't really have an option. So it's interesting to have this other opportunity here with Pledge, where they can actually allow you to keep buying the album all the way up to the release and really increase the revenues for the artist that way. Jay, did you have any? Have you heard anything in terms of artists using Indiegogo versus Pledge versus Kickstarter? Or
I've certainly seen some artists go the Indiegogo route, and I don't know what about it honestly made them go that way. I know that George Clinton was doing a big thing on Indiegogo, but to be honest, I'm not familiar enough with kind of the pros and cons of each of those as why you're seeing that happen.
Yeah,
I don't know if Glenn knows, but.
you know, Pledge Music looks like it looks like a little more of a platform you use to take pre-orders sometimes, and I think artists use it to really keep in touch with fans along the whole recording process.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right. So I think we should move on from. Sorry.
That seems to be one of the main differences I see so far.
Yeah.
That Pledge Music is used for really updating people during the recording process. Ben Folds did a really good job of that. Keeping people in the loop during the recording of the project, and leading up to the release, and I think that was Benji's intention, is to kind of keep people connected to the project while you're making it.
Yeah, for sure. And moving on from crowdfunding to streaming, there were a bunch of news this week on streaming services, and it really seems like 2013 is going to be like the year of the war breaks out between all of them, and they're really trying to grab a piece of the market, because you know it's kind of a float or sink type scenario at this point. So first of all, Rardio announced that it was adding a free 6-month trial period to service in an additional 14 territories. So that had been available in the USA since 2011, but the company must have realized that it was kind of hard to grab a piece of Spotify or Deezer's market in territories like the UK, for example, without the free trial, because they need the funnel to actually get people to convert into the paid. The interesting thing about Audio is that they don't offer, it's not ad based, so they're actually bearing all the costs of licensing for those 6 months. And do you guys reckon that's kind of dangerous in terms of how much that's gonna run up for them and the sustainability of the project in general, Jay?
Yeah, I mean, I think subscription music business in general is dangerous. I mean, it's fraught with casualties for, you know, you were saying this is the big year of the battle. I mean, the battle, this is a war that's been going on,
oh yeah,
you know, a decade and continues to go. So just more skirmishes kind of along the way. So, yeah, I mean, I get it's a hard, you know, it's a hard problem to solve, because you're competing with, you've got this great value proposition. RDO is a great product. But you're competing on the free on-demand side against YouTube, and on the free curation side against Pandora.
Yeah.
And so if you're coming out and all you've got is a paid tier up front, you're kind of stuck, and you've got to be really comfortable with a really slow growth curve, which when you've got investors kind of, you know, knocking on your door saying, what's going on, hurry up, you got to figure out ways to accelerate that. So, I mean, I absolutely think it's dangerous, you know, but that doesn't mean it won't work.
Yeah.
It is just, you got to be able to really have kind of the intestinal fortitude to see this through. But I mean, I do think there is a lot of people talk about the race to the bottom. I do think it's really dangerous. I mean, I think you see guys like Deezer and Spotify who raise a bunch of money, and you know, kind of the joke I always make is they raise all this money, they hold their breath, and they swim down to the bottom of the ocean, and they wait for everybody else to follow them. Until they all run out of air and they float to the top, right? And then they come back up and say, okay, cool, you know, everybody else is gone. So anybody that's not massively funded is going to have that problem. But the problem for everybody else is becoming massively funded.
Yep.
And the dangers associated on that side. So, yeah, I mean, dangerous. I hope it works out for them.
Yep.
But I really think it's dangerous for everybody in that spot.
Yeah. So are you taking a chance, Glenn, here?
Well, yeah, but it's a chance they have to take, right? Deezer, Spotify have forced their hand. You know, like Jay said, it's a risky business. You know, it's a business where, from a venture capitalist point of view, there's going to be one winner. There might be two winners. There probably won't be three winners.
Yeah.
And so, if you don't get big enough, you're not going to win. And I think that's what RDO was looking at. That's what Mog was looking at.
Yeah.
If you don't get people into the funnel, so to speak, you're not gonna convert them into paying customers.
Yeah.
And Spotify knew early on that if you don't have a free tier to get them listening, and at least have a chance to convert them into paying customers, you're not gonna reach scale enough to make this model work. And that's the economic reality of these licensing deals they have. There's no way around it.
I mean, yeah. I think Glenn brings up a good point about how many viable competitors that can be, and you know, there's kind of this half-baked theory I have that every market can support about 2.5 competitors, right? Desktop OS, you know, Windows, Mac, Linux, mobile carriers, you know, Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, you know, maybe there's Sprint in there, whatever. But you're really only talking about 2.5-3 guys that are going to have big, viable businesses. I think there's lots of opportunity for niche providers. But the guys that want to go really big and really wide, there's only going to be a couple spots. And then you got guys, and I know we're going to talk about later, that, you know, the handset manufacturers that say, we want a piece of this business too. So they got a lot of money to throw around as well.
Yeah. And Glenn, do you have any info? Because I was trying to find on Crunchbase to work out what Arduo's funding situation was like, and I couldn't really find anything public beyond 2011, really. Do you think they might have been receiving additional funding from, you know, Janusz Fries, who, of course, is a co-founder of Skype and has pretty deep pockets, who founded the company?
Well, I don't know. We could speculate all day.
Yeah, of course.
Nothing's been made public on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Samsung has also serious plans for its content division and streaming. So I actually heard Darren Tsui, the CEO of M-Spot, which is a company acquired by Samsung last year in 2012. And soon to be rebranded as Samsung Music Hub, speaking really bullishly about the company and about the opportunities for music on Samsung, and really Samsung putting a lot of weight behind its content division to make sure that it's properly funded and it can go ahead and make some strides. And also it was revealed that they plan on bringing the Samsung Music Hub to non-Samsung devices this year. So how do you feel about hardware companies that are moving into this space? You know, we have HTC now with Moog, which is now Daisy, you know, Sonic with this Music Unlimited services, and now Samsung with the Music Hub. So, Glenn, how do you feel about this second sort of tier of companies that are not, you know, specifically working on music, but they want to be in that space?
Yeah, you know, every smartphone manufacturer has a music play to some degree, and some of them take it really seriously and have music, you know, in their bones, and some of them really don't take it too seriously.
Yeah.
You know, Samsung did acquire M-Spot, and you know, from what I can see, that really hasn't played any part in their turnaround and in their success. I would encourage you to go to the Music Hub website and just take a look at that and see if that's played any part in Samsung's financial success. I would say the answer is a clear no.
Yeah.
It's got to be the ugliest website I've ever seen in my life. I think on paper, Music Hub is a good product. I think it makes a lot of sense. But how it actually works in real life and how it's delivered is a different question. So I think they have the right idea, definitely.
Yeah. And he also, I was kind of surprised because I always look at these services almost being, you know, a bottomless pit for these companies, because of course for them, the amount of money they spend on the services is almost nothing compared to what their turnover is as a company and their profits, especially looking at Samsung. But the CEO was actually really bullish in saying that Samsung does not want this to be, you know, the company subsidizing its music service, but it wants to stand on its own two feet. Do you think that was just talk, or is it actually something that they might be aiming for?
You know, I think the fact that they are moving to make it available beyond just Samsung devices speaks to the fact that they are looking at the bigger picture. And I applaud the fact that they're doing that. I think consumers, particularly music consumers, have become kind of wily enough to know and smell when they're trying to be locked in.
Yeah.
And you see pushback on that, on whether it's a carrier trying to lock them in or it's the handset manufacturer or anybody else. So I love the idea that they're going to say this is available everywhere. I would argue, for whatever it's worth, which is zero, that it shouldn't be branded Samsung.
Yeah.
But if they wanted to really compete in this space. So I mean, it seems to be that they're making the right moves in terms of making it open. You know, one of the problems with, and I know this well just from the stuff I've worked on, one of these problems with these hybrid services is trying to get the value proposition across in a way that people actually understand it without having to get out a calculator and, you know, a slide rule and a right, you know, right triangle. So a lot of these guys still have this problem of you get this many tracks, but you can download this, but you can't download this, and you can cache this, and this goes to your locker. You know, ultimately, I think all that messaging needs to be just really compressed and be, you know, it just plays.
Yeah.
Right. And this is always, you know, this is me kind of promoting, you know, pushing my own philosophy, but you know, people don't want to put music somewhere, they just want their music available everywhere. So try to just, I mean, I think everybody needs to try to remove all of the consideration that goes into consuming music, whether it be from streaming or downloads or whatever. Just like, yeah, I thought of a song, or I haven't thought of a song, just play me the stuff that, you know, I like or might like. So
yeah.
So yeah, I mean, you know, just to swing back to Samsung, they seem to be viewing it that way. So, you know, I applaud them for that.
Yeah. Glenn, do you think it's viable for them to make it a sustainable self-sustained business?
You know, who knows? Who knows? I mean, they'll give it a shot. You know, like Jay said, there's might be room for 2.5 successful players in this segment.
We have, you know, like seven.
Apple, Amazon, and Google are in there, and yeah, you know, they're going to be three formidable competitors. So,
well, that's, I think, more. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great, and you know, this could be a whole episode, maybe. But my ever evolving conspiracy theories about what Apple will not do in streaming. You know, at this point, I'm not considered that they're ever going to get into that space. Which is, I know, kind of contrarian to what everybody else thinks, but you know, I think to your, this kind of goes back to your Samsung point. If you're running iTunes at a $2+ billion a year business, if you're running it at break even, you could say, you know what, I could take a lot of those resources and not be in the music business, upsell everybody else's music business, take a 30%, you know, big off of them, and be done with it.
Yeah.
And you know, music got them the iPod got them the iPhone's got them apps, which gets them the money. So yeah, my current theory is maybe they're done. I mean, they obviously could do it, would be massively successful if they did it.
Yeah.
But sure, there's got to be conversations of, you know, we got what we needed out of it. You know, so I don't know. I don't know how controversial that is, but that's my latest theory.
And who knows? Maybe there are conversations going on in terms of, you know, there's a lot of talk about the sustainability of Apple's success in terms of their innovation and the fact that they've they perhaps slowed down and they need to release a new product to really break through again. And maybe that's that conversation is going to spur them to further their chats on delivering some sort of different music service that is not just iTunes. Who knows? All right. Well, and as you know, talking about hardware companies, we're also going to talk quickly about Sony. So, as the debate surrounding high quality audio rages on, you know, I had conversations on Medium with developers who were talking about how they really, you know, want lossless for all their audio and they rip everything and on FLAC and everything. With people that think that MP3s are perfectly fine, I even have I had an interview with a pianist Lang Lang, who said that he's perfectly fine with MP3s, and which was surprising to me because I know that classical music companies are really pushing to pushing lossless to, as a way to convert people to digital because of the audio quality. So Sony also released its sort of high quality audio a service through the Sony Music Unlimited, and this is powered by Omniphone because of course Omniphone powers the Sony Music Unlimited service, and it offers 320 kilobytes per second streaming, which is actually the same as Spotify's Extreme setting, from what I could find. So, you know, what do you make towards the move, you know, of the move towards high quality audio? And do you think, you were talking about value proposition, Jay, you know, are people more concerned with value proposition or audio quality at this point?
I mean, you know, to massively overgeneralize, I don't think people care about audio quality. And I think that's proven by the fact that most people walk around with a pair of 25-cent white earbuds in their ears, right?
Yeah.
And so you see a move towards, obviously, like, you know, Beats by Dre and other high-end headphones, but I would argue that's more of a fashion statement than an audiophile statement.
Yeah.
You know, to really appreciate this lossless stuff, you've got to balance against the convenience, right? So when I see 320K streaming, my first question is, well, what format is that? Because, you know, 320K MP3 versus, you know, AUG or AAC is going to be different. But then I think, okay, well, most people won't know that or care about that. But when my second thought is, great, there goes my bandwidth caps, right? I don't want to stream at 320. I don't want to download at lossless because the convenience of having it with me or being able to get it far outweighs kind of the audio quality, and most people don't even have a stereo in their living room anymore. So I think it's a red herring, honestly. I think we're in the world of good enough audio.
Yeah.
There's a very small percentage of people that are going to want lossless, and they're going to have great speakers and a great system and everything else, but that is like, you know, a fraction of a percent, I think.
Yeah. Glenn?
Yeah, it's, I think they're putting the cart before the horse here and thinking that people have this great desire for great sounding audio in the living room, and it's really not, you know, digital music is more of a portable thing, like Jay said.
Yeah.
While there are more Beats by Dre headphones than crappy white earbuds these days, which is I think moving the right direction, there's still a lot of crappy white earbuds.
Yeah,
an awful lot. And I think long term the move will be toward better quality, but it's a slow process.
Yeah,
it's a long term play. So
yeah,
so nothing to get too excited about just yet, I don't think. Yeah. I think the move to the living room is also a long term thing, more of a niche thing right now.
Absolutely. And so, Glenn, you also wrote a story yesterday, I think it was, about Japan's latest figures for 2012 in terms of music sales. So I'm always interested every couple of weeks to look at one of the territories, especially this month, as there are a lot of the figures coming out of the 2012 year in terms of music sales. And incredibly, for the first time since, I think it was 1998 in Japan, you wrote, shipment of CDs were up 8%. But the country is very much behind the curve when it comes to streaming services. So how do you think that the story will progress in Japan in terms of how music is consumed?
Well, you know, Japan is just a complete island, literally and figuratively, unto itself. It is very vastly different from North America and Western Europe. So it's behind the times digitally. Most of its downloads come from mobile, and those tanked last year. Those were down about 40%. And it's, you know, ringtone business is still quite big. Yeah. So the internet download market is still not as mature, and it might not even get there because now it looks like Spotify might be coming into the market this year. And the CD market is still stubborn, and it actually went up last year. So it's just a very unique market.
Yeah.
And it looks like, from the report I read at McClure Music, that it was just maybe the releases that came out last year were what drove the increase in CD sales.
Yeah, it's a bit like their very own Adele.
The local homegrown artist just had a great year, and that was really behind the increase in CD sales.
Yeah, and yeah, looking at technology, of course, you know, it's kind of weird to think of Japan as a country that is behind the curve digitally, considering that a lot of people think about Japan as a very tech-forward country. And I mean, when I went a couple of years ago, and still, you could see maybe 80% of people had their proprietary phones that they have over there, which of course are not compatible with anything that's out there at the moment. So that was a big problem as well for services that wanted to expand into that territory. But it looks like the adoption of Android is going through the roof, and people are abandoning these proprietary systems, and also iOS is doing pretty well. So do you think that might help Spotify when it does land in Japan to get a piece of the market there?
Yeah, I mean, obviously all those, you know, having a platform that's actually common is going to be a huge benefit. I mean, I know that, Glenn, Napster was there for a while, right?
It was, yeah, that shut down a few years ago.
Okay, and it just never really happened. I'm sure it had to do with mobile and just how much of it was going on mobile. And as you know, as one of these services or one of these providers, the thought of developing yet another app for yet another platform is, you know, you quickly do the cost benefit on that and say, okay, well, maybe it's not worth it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, just in general, open platform, the ability to build stuff that's cross-platform. And, you know, with a couple tweaks, great, it's available. Obviously for Spotify and RDO and everybody else, having to jump through all the hoops of the territorial licensing is not a trivial task. But
yeah.
Once you've done that, being able to roll it out to a platform that is common is going to make things a lot easier.
Yeah. And I kind of seem to recall, I don't know if I'm making this up, but I seem to recall that last year there was a law passed in Japan as well that posed much stricter penalties on piracy as well. I think it included jail time, and it was pretty tough. So I wonder whether that's got anything to do with the rise of CD sales on the front. Yeah.
But yeah, I do recall that as well, although I haven't read anything about that recently. And that's one of the difficulties of laws like that being passed in Asia, the same, a similar law was passed in South Korea, and there's just not much English language news coming out of those countries.
Yeah.
So you don't read too much about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And last news coming out of MIDEM was, you know, it's a follow-up from last week's conversation where we talked about, you know, Merlin expressing its disappointment over MySpace's, you know, handling of the licensing situation for independent labels. And at MIDEM, actually, AWIN, which is a worldwide independent music industry network that represents indie music industry bodies worldwide, made a very, very strong statement against MySpace and against the way it decided to launch, condemning MySpace towards its attitude with indie labels. So MySpace did not renew its deal with Merlin and maintains that as tracks that are infringing must be uploaded from users, the only way labels have to remove those tracks from the service is to issue takedown notices, which of course is a hugely you know, cumbersome and long process, especially if you have multiple versions of the same track on the system. So you know, the chair of WIN even went on to say that it's absolutely repugnant, which I don't think I've ever heard that word expressed in a sentence recently, that to the spirit of cooperation and the balancing of interest commercial, that this should have been MySpace's response. So you know, what's the stake here for MySpace, and you know, can they recover from this huge blow from the independent market, Glenn?
Yeah, you know, I think they can recover. I don't know too much about this. I just know what was really said in the press conference, and yeah. You know, what I would say is, you know, if indie labels held a press conference, I think that says something about how frustrated and angry they are, because labels just don't go hold a press conference unless they're really mad and unless things broke down in discussions.
Yeah.
And so that sends a signal right there. So that's about really all I know.
Yeah, sure.
And I think it's very strange that MySpace would expect indie artists to just upload their tracks individually and not expect to be remunerated in any way.
Yeah.
As if they're just hobbyists all of a sudden.
Yeah.
I find that really strange. You know, MySpace is a business, and independent artists are business, and I would expect them to handle this professionally. Not as hobbyists. So
yeah,
so it's just a strange occurrence.
And they're also annoyed with the majors because apparently what they said is that they think that around 40%, although there's no confirmation really of that that I know of, 40% of MySpace is you know, the stake is held by major labels. So the fact that they launched the service without making provisions for ways to identify and take down non-licensed tracks, and they launched like that, it's kind of a pretty bad thing for them as well. What do you reckon, Jay?
I think it's you know, it's just kind of interesting to see the approach that they took, right? And one of letting that license lapse with Merlin, and two, the fact that they, I mean, I don't think there's a problem today on the new MySpace of people uploading tracks.
Yeah.
All of those tracks that they're complaining about are legacy. They came from the original MySpace that have been up there for, you know, 10 years. So I think it's interesting that they kept all that content when they relaunched, as opposed to saying, we're going to come in and do this kind of, you know, fully licensed deal from the get-go. I mean, I think their view seems to be, you know, if you're on a major, we'll pay. If you're not on a major, then think of us like you think of SoundCloud, right?
Yeah.
Put your stuff up here for free. And that part of, that deck, that leaked, you know, investor deck that was out earlier this year or last year, basically said that, you know, we've got all this content from all these indies that we don't have to pay for. And I think the hope is pay for the big stuff to generate the audience. The audience will generate the demand from the artists to want to get their stuff in with the big stuff, and try to, you know, just simplify those arrangements.
Yeah.
But it is interesting. And, you know, I was asking for a long time, and I still don't know the details of it. Before they relaunched, like, what happened to those deals with the majors from the old MySpace? And I don't know how those were renegotiated or what the structure is or anything else, or even the ownership of how the, you know, the entity of MySpace Music factored into the whole sale and acquisition and everything else. So I'd be curious to know kind of what the structure of all that stuff is, but
yeah.
I have no knowledge.
All right. All right. Well, I wanted to end the show by talking about Midem quickly. Just, you know, get you guys get your impression, guys, because you weren't there, and it's interesting just to see from afar what your impression was of the conference, of the news that came out of it, and its relevance really for the future. Glenn,
I think we should be talking to you more than you should be asking us for opinions. You were there. I would love to hear your thoughts.
Well, you know, I thought it was really interesting for the tech side. It felt like it was very vibrant. And, you know, people from like Emily White, you know, she said that, you know, I was impressed to hear her say that for her, Medium was incredibly important. And, you know, she made some amazing connections and you know, managed to reach out to a number of territories that she wouldn't otherwise be able to reach out to or be able to distribute the music of her artists to. So in that sense, it seems like it's still very relevant. Of course, that the attendance was down of a few percentage points over last year. And it did feel like the attendance was down, but at the same time, it seems like the quality of the meetings that were had from everybody that I spoke to, from Zomando to a bunch of other companies, said that they had better meetings, more productive meetings, and actually made some deals there. So on that front, on the business front, it seemed like it went great. I didn't really see many panels because I did about 25 interviews over 3.5 days, so it was pretty hectic. But now I was also interested to hear from you guys, just because, you know, the stuff is really filters out when it comes outside of the conference. When you're in there, you're immersed in it, and it seems like everything is important. But when you're outside of it, like, you might have a different opinion as to whether anything actually relevant came out of it in terms of news. And maybe its relevance is in the fact that if you're there, you can make deals, rather than actually news coming out of the trade show. I don't know, Jay.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of news, you know, the announcement, and I don't even know what actually was announced at Meetup or just around.
Yeah.
You know, timing. You know, the Samsung announcement is interesting. The Deezer expansion is interesting. The audio stuff is all interesting. So, you know, from that, I think those were the things that kind of that I noticed. It running over the weekend doesn't help in terms of noticing what news happens. There's a lot of people kind of disconnected. But sure. I think that the larger kind of more macro thing that's going on that I think is interesting is how just tech is finally being more embraced into the music industry, right? It used to be about the artists, the labels, the publishers, the retailers, right? And now the retailers are kind of getting phased out, and the tech community is kind of filling that void of the old, you know, historical physical retailer. And I think you see like NARM, you know, looking at that in a new way, which is great.
Yeah.
And you're seeing that happen at Meetup. You know, an event like Meetup, I think it's great to have the confluence of those kind of communities there. The problem is, of course, for the tech community is, you know, it was going to cost me something like $10,000 to go to meet him, right? And it's just like, I can't make that work, right? That doesn't
no.
That equation doesn't work for a guy that's running a startup and, you know, more than we've spent in 3 years in development.
Yeah.
To go and spend a, you know, few days and you know, $30 a drink at the Carlton.
Yeah,
so
absolutely. You're right.
So I would love to see that event. Although South of France is beautiful, I would love to see that event happen, you know, in New York or LA or you know, somewhere a little bit closer for
absolutely.
Most of us.
Absolutely. And Glenn, let's talk about Billboard. You know, there was a big rebranding of the site the other day, and quite a few new features coming up. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, you know, the magazine has been redesigned. I mean, completely overhauled. So not just the look, but different pages, different sections. The websites have also been overhauled. You know, Billboard.com was redesigned, I don't know, a couple of years ago, and the business section, Billboard.biz, which is now Billboard.com/biz, is also got completely overhauled.
Yeah.
For the first time in quite a while, and it looks fantastic.
Yeah, it's absolutely great, and I would encourage anybody to go and sign up to Billboard, because it's a great value for money for the amount of news that you bring out every day. So
everything's been rebranded with a, you know, similar but different logo.
Yeah.
And everything right down to the country newsletters and the top 40 newsletters that come out free every week.
Yeah.
Everything has the unified look and different look, and has made our lives hell for the last few weeks. And Bill Birdie's held life for a long time, or his life held for a long time, I'm sure. You know,
cool.
Like, I would like to point out, you know, there's a lot of news. You know, Jay, you mentioned the RDO news and the Deezer news. And I think in Meetup, the message was probably, you know, digital and streaming is our future, right? And then Ben Cesario of the New York Times puts out an article 2 days ago about how, you know, people are frustrated about the royalties from subscription services. And again, mixed messages from the industry about this, because it's not just a few artists who are complaining. If you read through the comments, it's a lot of labels and indie labels who are complaining and yep. don't want their music on those services still. Now, a lot of labels are happy with subscription services, but still a lot of them aren't.
Yeah,
it's really fascinating that people have such mixed feelings about these services still. So I think that's something that is just going to be an ongoing story,
yeah.
an ongoing conversation about, you know, why is it that these royalties are not good enough? Where is this money going? Because it's not going in the pockets of these labels, and obviously these services aren't keeping it because they're not making any profit. So. It must be going somewhere. I just don't know where it is.
Yeah. That's funny.
Advances and guarantees.
Yeah. Potentially. And no, so that's great. And and Jay, you know, anything you want to plug or talk about your end?
You know, just as I always do, you know, just we got a bunch of great new stuff coming out with and around Tomahawk. We just pushed out a new version, .6, about 2 weeks ago.
Just super stable. Yeah,
it is getting better every day. So, and we really get some great momentum around some really exciting new stuff that you know should happen over the next couple months. So,
great.
So keep an eye out for that on the web and mobile and a whole bunch of other stuff that's kind of cooking. So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much. And thanks so much for being on the show. And you can check out Digital Music Trends on digitalmusictrends.com and also on all the other channels that I mentioned at the beginning of the show. If you want to email, it's digitalmusictrends@gmail.com or Twitter @DGMusicTrends. I'm going to put links for these guys' Twitter accounts and websites as well in case you want to start following them. Thanks so much, guys, for being on the show. And hope I'll see you soon.
Great. Sure. Thanks, guys.